Bob McMahon, the governor's science advisor. We want to give him a big round of applause and let him share his story with us. Thanks again.
Now, what is it that you want me to talk about first here? Because, you know, I feel like I've missed my calling as a beat poet standing up here on the stage with a microphone and a white hot spotlight. So,
a white hot spotlight.
That's right. That's right. But with a name like McMahon, I'm certainly at home in a pub with a rampant lion on my left-hand side. Cheers. It's nice to be here. Thank you very much.
What we generally start out with is just a little bit of background, kind of where you're from, how do you get into, you know, what's the science thing you're involved in, how does astronomy somehow link into being the governor's science advisor and what you do there? So,
that's the really hard part, actually. Okay. Let me make my adjustments here. That looks so good, I think I'd rather be at the table right there. I have what I like to call a career that only makes sense in the rearview mirror. And it really does only make sense in the rearview mirror. I started out as a research academic. I was up in Cambridge at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics doing my scholarly work and publishing articles in journals and doing research in large-scale structure of the universe and cosmology and doing some side work in instrumentation and scientific instrumentation, mostly to make the perform the measurements that I needed for my research. And this was research at the time in cosmology. I know there's been one cafe on dark matter, and that's certainly a very hot and urgent topic in cosmology. When I started doing research in cosmology, we were actually doing the foundational observations that implied the existence of dark matter and is actually a foundational element of dark matter theory. We were looking at how matter is distributed on the largest scales in the universe and looking at galaxies and clusters of galaxies and the way they move and the way they're distributed as markers for the underlying distribution of all matter in the universe. And when you do this, you look at how galaxies, the things that are glowing out in space, are distributed, and you say, this cannot be the total picture. It doesn't make sense that this is the total picture. In fact, one of my great moments as a scientist early on was back in the days, I keep telling my students, teaching introductory astrophysics this term, and I was talking about a supernova, and I said in a recent supernova 1987A, we found the following, and I looked up and I got this really blank look from all my students and kind of this snicker, you know, as only late teens can give you with, you know, and they said, and I said, what did I say? And they kind of, a couple young ladies in the front row kind of giggled, and they said, 1987 is not recent since we were born in 1989. I said, okay, well, I guess you can all go home now because this lecture is completely. But back in those days, in the heady days of cosmology, we couldn't actually plot data that we would collect on the screen. We couldn't plot it. We had to actually send it to a laser printer to plot it. I don't know if many of you, and there were these arcane plotting routines. So we had actually aggregated the largest collection of positional data for galaxies, the deepest collection that had ever been aggregated to date. And we, for the first time, we plotted it out. We didn't know what it looked like. We sent it to the plotter to see what the distribution of matter looked like. And I can remember the day we're all sitting around the laser printer looking down, you know, as the paper rolls out, and it rolls out upside down, of course, and we reach down and kind of casually turn it over, and the plot that we saw was completely, absolutely wrong. It contradicted all of our assumptions about how it should look. It was absolutely not. And we went back, of course, we said, well, we plotted it wrong. We went through pretty much a tree before we convinced ourselves that, in fact, the data were right and that what we were seeing was a view of the universe that no one had ever seen before and a secret, an underlying truth about how the universe is organized on the largest scales. And to that day, I tell the story, I still get chills on my spine when I think about that moment, like 8 p.m. sitting in front of a laser printer in a hallway, a nondescript hallway, where we for the first time saw a distribution, a piece of data put together that ultimately gave rise, in part, to the development of dark matter theories as an explanation for what we were seeing. What was I talking about? I got off on this subject. Okay, that's the first part of the career. Well, we were doing this. I got interested in. I came from being a physicist is somewhat of a genetic anomaly, and it tends to run in families, I think. And my father was a physicist, and my uncle was a physicist, and they were entrepreneurial physicists. And they, when I was growing up, I was a young man, 10 years old. They had started a series of companies, a few failures to start, but ultimately they built a very, very large laser manufacturer, one of the largest gas laser manufacturers in the country, in the world at the time. And so as a nine-year-old kid, I was running around laser physicists, and of course, these were the good old days before OSHA got a hold of lasers, and they would turn these things on and burn and see how many fire bricks they could burn holes through as a measure of the power of the laser. In fact, one of the nice crossover applications was that they designed and built a laser that was first used to range the moon in some of the early lunar ranging experiments. But so I was in this environment of entrepreneurship, and when I was up at Harvard, we were doing some really neat things with technology and the instrumentation side. And I said, this would make a good product. We should do this. And so I spun a company out, and the company managed to take over my life. And the department chairs were gracious, and they gave me time off and leave that I hadn't earned and sabbatical that I didn't deserve. And they finally said, you've got to make a decision what you're going to do on this. And it was just too much fun. So I moved the company down here to North Carolina and built it over the next 10 years, and it became quite large ultimately. It had divisions in a number of states and a number of countries, and that company was eventually sold, and I took an operating role in the Swiss company that bought us, and so I was going around the world managing engineering and product development and research staff with more egos of different types than one can possibly imagine. I thought that it was hard dealing with engineers, but I didn't know that when you put engineers of different nationalities and equivalent national pride together, that there was no really easy compromise between these divisions. And after I did that, I actually, after I was there for a number of years, I had the opportunity to join a venture capital firm, but a unique venture capital firm. It's a venture capital firm that is, it's operated for the CIA. It's in Washington, D.C. The CIA, yes, the CIA has a venture capital firm. And they do because they realized in the information technologies, explosion of information technology and securities, they realized that they prided themselves at being technology leaders, right? You know, they were 10 years ahead of the current state of the art, but all of a sudden they found out they weren't 10 years ahead. They were actually behind what was happening in San Jose and other areas. So they created a venture capital firm to take advantage of the innovations that were happening in the private sector. And it was there when I was there... happily bouncing back and forth and looking at all sorts of interesting technologies when I got a call from the governor and from the Secretary of Commerce to join the state administration and as the science advisor. And that was an interesting opportunity and presented a number of challenges. One, for 10 or 15 years building a company in North Carolina, I said, if only they would do this. And then somebody actually called my bluff and said, okay, this is your chance. Come and tell us what we should do. And two, North Carolina has a long and proud history of building a science and technology-based economy and is, I think, is really unique in the United States in many ways in the ferocity and the speed at which whole sectors of the North Carolina economy have changed over a few decades. If you look at North Carolina in the 1950s, in like 1950, North Carolina had the In terms of per capita state income, we were 48th in the United States in 1950. And almost three-quarters of our workforce was engaged in textiles, furniture, and tobacco, those three industries. Today, those three industries make up about 4% of gross state product. And so we've had an enormous displacement and an enormous transition. And in many ways, North Carolina has been at the forefront of reorienting its economy and realigning its economic strategies around technology and science as drivers. But the problem is, and the challenge that we have today, is that everybody noticed and learned from our example, and you go to other places in the world, and you go to other states, and you go to other regions, and you see that they have learned our lessons well. And they are moving very aggressively. So where we have leadership positions, we were the first state. We started a biotechnology center. We started a biotechnology effort in North Carolina before people even agreed that biotechnology was something you should put, that was something to invest in. It was not a field. And yet now today we're the third largest state in biotechnology activity. Biotechnology, depending on how you measure it, as a single domain in the sciences, is a $15 to $20 billion contributor to gross state product. That's an industry that's been built out of whole cloth in 30 years. And it's been built on the leverage that we have created through investments in education and universities and the like. I have to say this story, you'll appreciate that. I was out in California recently. I was invited to, the National Academies have an office out in California at the Beckman Center, and I was invited to give a talk out there on state science policy and science and technology. And the host, very gracious host, there was a representative of the California government there, and it got up and said, well, California was the first state in the country to really take science and technology development seriously, and we created a science and technology-based economic development office in the mid-70s. And then he went on. And I came a few people later, and I said, it's difficult for me to say this, because I said, North Carolina is known as the valley of humility between two mountains of conceit. So being from the valley of humility, it's difficult for me to say this, but in fact, California was not the first. North Carolina did it 15 years before that, and in fact, we were. But again, the challenge is maintaining that position and building upon it, because although we have successfully developed a technology economy that is the envy of many places, it is geographically concentrated in North Carolina, and North Carolina has suffered some of the largest kind of base manufacturing dislocations of any state in the U.S. So our continuing challenge is, how do you prepare workforce? How do you transition the entirety of the North Carolina economy around these areas? Now you're standing up. Does that mean I'm running too long?
It means you're getting there.
Okay, I'm getting there. Can I read you a couple things? You know, I was on a plane. It was actually out to this meeting in California. I was on a plane and I was reading an article. And when you talk about the new economy and science and technology policy, there's nothing better than some of these. I was reading this essay. It was by Norm Augustine, who was the chairman of the committee that produced the National Academies report, Rising Above the Gathering Storm, which I think is a terrible name, and I've told him so. I said, it's not a gathering storm. We're in the middle of the storm. We may be in the eye of the hurricane right now, but we're in a hurricane, and we're in the middle of it. We're not waiting for it to come. And I think some of the comments in his essay, actually, he wrote an essay a year after the report was released that encapsulated some of his thinking on these issues. And there are a couple of quotes.
No, go ahead.
Be good? There are a couple of things here that I think really kind of frame. We are in a period in our evolution that historians, I think, very fairly will look back at this time as nothing short of and nothing less than the kind of fundamental shift and dislocation that was experienced in the Industrial Revolution. I mean, it is the kind of thing that, in a couple of these quotes, actually emphasizes. It is that we are living through a period where the fundamental rules by which the world and the world economy works have changed. And we can actually, unlike many of these things, I mean, you can point to in the Industrial Revolution, you can point to the development of the Iron Bridge in England. You can actually point to the date when it happened, and that was December 31st, 1999 was the date when it happens. Because on that date, I was rushing to the ATM machine to get $200 out, because I was sure that the entire financial and banking system of the United States, with the exception, of course, of our North Carolina banks, was going to collapse at that point, and nothing was going to work, and those with cash, gold, and other valuables would be the only ones that could eat. But in fact, the amazing thing about December 31st, 1999, was that absolutely nothing happened. Because January 1st of 2000 represented the end game and the beginning and the marker, the milestone of this transition. Because for the decade before that, we started to try to accommodate, try to correct the errors, the coding inconsistencies that were going to crash all the computer systems that were going to cause this problem. And in doing so, what we found out is that, well, we didn't have enough people in the United States to do this. Not enough engineers, not enough software. So we said, well, we'll send some of the easy stuff to some of the engineers overseas to do this. Well, how can we do this? Well, we've built all these networks, and we have all this bandwidth and all this broadband capacity, so we can move the data. And we built collaboration software, and we built the tools to enable virtual collaboration and to eliminate the distance. And those worked. And then when we moved those things over, we found that, you know, they're pretty good. They could actually do the work. And that date was the catalyst for the shrinking of the globe, in essence. The point at which we found out that you could move things seamlessly across the globe. And in fact, my first quote speaks to that. It says, it has been referred by Francis Cairncross of The Economist, the death of distance, a phenomenon whereby in many circumstances parties to transactions no longer need to be physically close to one another. When first considered, that may seem rather mundane, but its consequences are already permeating the lives of almost all the citizens of the planet, and they are profound indeed. Richard Riley estimates that the top 10 jobs of a handful of years from now don't even exist today. That makes preparation particularly challenging and places a premium on the contributions of creative people with broad experience. Here's another. In Washington, D.C., today, visitors to an office building not far from the White House are greeted by a pleasant woman whose image appears on a flat screen display in the lobby, where she handles appointments, access, and other administrative matters. But she's not in Washington, she's in Pakistan. The question arises, will we all end up working with McDonald's? The answer is no. Because those jobs aren't safe either. McDonald's, it seems, has been experimenting with a centralized order-taking system wherein drive-through customers speak their meal requests into a voice recorder that transmits them via synchronous equatorial satellite orbiting some 23,000 miles above the Earth to a central facility staffed by people who are expert in taking orders. The requests are then re-entered digitally and transmitted via satellite to the person who prepares hamburgers and fries, a communication equivalent to 4 transits around the Earth. Using this process, McDonald's has cut its error rate in half and it's increased its throughput by 30%. Now think about that. You know, I've actually visited one of these McDonald's, and it is absolutely seamless. You walk up to the box and you go, and it's still bad fidelity. You can send it around the globe, but the speaker's still really poor. And you know, and you tell the order, and it comes up on the board, and you drive around, and by the time you drive around, you notice that the person fulfilling your order has your order in front of them and your picture. And that picture and that order were taken by someone in Colorado and beamed to you via satellite to that McDonald's in Massachusetts. Now, what that means is, fundamentally, is the marginal cost of moving information across the globe is now effectively zero. And that has profound implications on business models, competitive position, especially when you take into account that other countries have learned from our lesson. And the skills, the technologies, the talent pools available in other places of the globe are formidable indeed. And interestingly, it's those places of the globe that are emphasizing, even more so than we are, science and technology as basic enablers of their economy and basic driving forces. In fact, if you look at places like Singapore, that we hold out as examples of very progressive communities, these are places that are fundamentally reorganizing basic governmental structures around science and technology as the basic economic drivers of our economy, of their economy. Their basic and fundamental government structures reflect the emphasis on technology as the main engine. Now, here's an interesting... It says, along those lines, it says, leaders of other nations very seldom overlook the ubiquitous impact of investments in science and technology. For example, of China's nine top leaders, the top nine leaders in China, eight are engineers and one is a geologist. In contrast, in the United States, the number of members of the most recent 435-member House of Representatives who listed their field as engineering was three, the same number who categorized themselves as actors. As for scientists, none was to be found in the Senate, but the representation in the House recently ballooned to five. And this is a great one. Talking about the number of traditional bachelor in engineering degrees awarded by U.S. universities. In absolute terms, the most recent data available from America's universities show nearly 44,000 students receiving law degrees, nearly 140,000 receiving MBAs, and over 64,000 receiving Bachelor of Science in Engineering, and 6,400 receiving PhDs in engineering, of whom 33% are U.S. citizens. In other terms, counting only U.S. citizens, for every new PhD engineering researcher we graduate, the nation produces 18 lawyers and 50 MBAs. The implicit strategy seems to be to sue ourselves to prosperity, or perhaps due to so through financial engineering. Now, the interesting thing about these quotes and this observation is the rest of the world is organizing around science and technology. If you go to Asia, and I have done this, and this is a common quote, but it's true. You go to Asia and you say, who do you want to be? You're more likely to get the answer, Bill Gates, God help them, than anyone else. Ask that same question in the United States. Engineering, science, and technology are seen as a gateway to betterment and prosperity in most parts of the world. I asked a question. I use in my class, I use these PRS clickers, these things of response systems. Students love them because they can vote. What they don't know is that it's electronic, so I know that they're there, and I know what they vote. And I recently asked a question. I was asking a question. I said, black hole event horizon has a radius of thing. And he asked them a question. The next question was, And then I slipped one in. I said, who would you rather have dinner with? And I said, and I had a series of my ABC choices. I don't remember what they were exactly, but it was... Tom Cruise and what's his wife's name? Pardon? Tom Cruise. It's Holmes. I said Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes, Angelina Jolie. That was a big hit. And I had Brad Pitt. And I don't remember which sports star, NFL star I put on there. And I put Jonas Salk. It was one of the choices. And then the last choice was probably Tom Cruise, but I don't know who Jonas Salk is. That last choice won. That choice won. And in fact, our students now emulate not only do they not know, their role models and their peers are emulating professions that are very different and are in stark contrast to the nations in which we compete. Here's a great, I'll just one more if I can find
I'll do you one more.
Okay.
And we're going to open it up.
Okay, I got one more here. I think this is a, if I can find it, there's a great one here.
Bum, bum, bum,
dun, 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 dun. Oh, see, now I'm having a trouble.
Okay, hold that thought. Let's get some questions in.
Oh, I think
or
I've
keep
got
looking
it.
And we'll get some questions. Here's one right here.
You mentioned that the industries in North Carolina have changed over the past 50 years. I have a two-part question. What are the current industries that are at the top in North Carolina, and where do you see North Carolina going in the next 20 to 30 years?
Well, the industrial base is much, much more diverse than it was, obviously. Tough question like that deserves a pause. It's interesting, if you look at the, and I'll answer your questions with a monologue, but it's interesting that if you look at the demographics of the U.S. workforce since the end of World War II, what we're talking about is basic dislocations in workforce in North Carolina and the U.S. today is actually the end game of a trend that has been in evidence since the end of World War II. The manufacturing component in the U.S. labor force has never been higher than it was in the last century, I should say, than at the end of World War II. There has been a steady and monotonic decline in the percentage of non-farm employment, non-farm payroll that's in the manufacturing sector. To where it started off at about 45% in the late 40s, 45, 50%. It's less than 10% today in the U.S. It's actually more like 5% in aggregate today. And in contrast, the services sector in the U.S. economy has grown similarly. So it's gone from a minority player to the majority player. So when you ask, what are the major industries in North Carolina? They're a broad array of industries. They're everything from financial services industries to, of course, biotechnology and science and technology industries. Manufacturing is still a very strong component of the North Carolina economy, even though we've had dislocations in some of the workforce. The issue with manufacturing, very often you hear the statement, I hear it bandied about textiles are dead. Well, actually, textiles are not dead in North Carolina. They're actually, in many places, alive and well. The problem is that those businesses don't employ the same numbers of people because technology displaces people in a race for increased productivity. What used to take 100 people to produce, now 2 people can do with a computer-operated piece of equipment. So many of the industries that we spoke of as traditional industries in North Carolina are still there, but they're just different, and they don't require the same levels of employment that they did at one time. So that is a vigorous hand-waving answer to your question. where there were single industries in North Carolina. We now see on a region-to-region basis a broad array of industries of different types. There are some standouts, like financial services. Charlotte is now the second largest financial center in the U.S. after New York, in terms of assets managed and controlled. Okay, so financial services is a major player in North Carolina. Obviously, there are technology spaces that are major players, manufacturing as well. Services and professional services of all types are incredibly important to the state as well. And one of the things that underlines that underscores that figure is if you look at the number of companies in North Carolina, there are, and the distribution of companies, there are approximately 3,000 companies in North Carolina that have more than 500 employees. 3,000. There are 160,000 that have under 500 employees. Now, roughly in terms of payroll and contribution to the state, those are roughly equivalent in terms of economic impact. But when you look at that small business sector, 140,000 have under 20 employees. So in terms of bulk employment, that is the sector which spreads over all of these industry clusters and really touches people all over the state. Is that an answer to your question?